KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The State Department says it is canceling nearly all of USAID's foreign assistance programs. The agency's been a frequent target of the new administration. Does it have a future? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. President Trump has delayed promised tariffs on Canadian and Mexican goods. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Could sweeping tariffs be the new infrastructure week, a promised policy that fails to materialize? Also, why Ukraine's rare earth minerals so appealing to the U.S.? And a new study shows the share of Americans who identify as Christians continues to fall. It's Thursday, February 27th. Happy birthday to Sarah Blakely, who turned Spanx into a billion-dollar business. She turns 54. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump is reversing course. In a post on social media this morning, the president says 25% tariffs on Mexican and Canadian imports will take effect next Tuesday. The president had said that he would hold off on implementing the taxes until April 2nd. The pause was to give Canada and Mexico time to prove that they were working to curb shipments of fentanyl into the United States. The Supreme Court has paused a lower court ruling that requires the Trump administration to pay nearly $2 billion in foreign assistance to the U.S. Agency for International Development. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports the White House has eliminated nearly 5,800 foreign assistance grants and awards, effectively gutting USAID.
The government still owes USAID grantees more than $1 billion. A federal district judge ordered USAID to restart payments by Wednesday night, but the Trump administration appealed to the Supreme Court, which paused the order. Officials said USAID eliminated about 92% worth of the agency's grants, while the State Department eliminated 28% worth. The government claimed a total savings of nearly $60 billion. Upon taking office, Trump ordered a pause in all USAID funding pending a comprehensive review. He called the agency, quote, in many cases, antithetical to American values. Frank Langfitt, NPR News.
Stocks on Wall Street opened higher this morning as the Labor Department reported a jump in the number of people applying for unemployment benefits. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow rose about 100 points in early trading.
Some 242,000 people applied for unemployment benefits last week. That's 22,000 more than the week before. Analysts say the widespread job cuts in the federal government won't begin to show up in the unemployment data for another couple of weeks. Orders for long-lasting manufactured goods rose more than 3% last month, better than forecasters had expected. Most of the jump reflects a rebound in commercial aircraft orders after a slump at the end of last year. Computer chip maker Nvidia delivered another dazzling earnings report, suggesting no let-up in demand for the hardware behind artificial intelligence. Nvidia's sales jumped 12% from the previous quarter and 78% from the same period a year ago. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Legendary actor Gene Hackman has died at the age of 95. His roles in Unforgiven and The French Connection earned him two Academy Awards. Hackman was also recognized as the supervillain in the Superman franchise.
Lex Luthor, the greatest criminal mind of our time.
Of our time.
I hereby serve notice.
Hackman was found dead alongside his wife in their home in New Mexico. Authorities don't believe foul play was involved. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. More than 20 people are hospitalized in West Texas amid an outbreak of measles that has left one child dead. The CDC says 124 confirmed cases of measles, mostly among teens and children, have been confirmed in the U.S. so far this year. The uptick comes as vaccination rates continue to fall in the United States. Two probes are headed for the moon today atop a SpaceX rocket. Joe Palco reports both are looking for evidence of water on the moon, one from lunar orbit and one from the lunar surface.
The probe that will land on the moon is called Athena. It's built by the Houston company Intuitive Machines. Athena carries a drill that is designed to burrow 3 feet into the rocks that make up the lunar surface, searching for underground water. The lander carries several other instruments, including a rover that will test a lunar communication system built by Nokia. The orbiter is called Lunar Trailblazer. It has instruments designed to not only pinpoint the location of water deposits, but also identify their form. Are they frozen ice? Are they water vapor? Are they water molecules bound to rocks? Knowing the nature of the water will be important if future astronauts hope to use the water as a resource that will allow prolonged visits to the moon. For NPR News, I'm Joe Palca.
Stocks on Wall Street are trading mixed at this hour. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 110 points. The Nasdaq Composite down 174. The S&P down 19 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
In a few minutes, we'll have an update on the measles outbreak that continues to spread in West Texas. But first,
the Trump administration is terminating nearly all foreign assistance programs run by the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID.
The move effectively guts the six-decade-old agency, which worked to prevent the spread of disease and eliminate poverty and other programs in more than 120 countries.
NPR Global Health Correspondent Fatma Tanis joins us now with the details. So Fatma, tell us what happened.
So the State Department says it's reviewed over 6,000 of USAID's foreign assistance grants, and Secretary of State Marco Rubio has decided to terminate nearly all of them, quote, as part of the America First agenda. Only 500 grants will be continued. Now, those grants funded all kinds of humanitarian and development projects aimed at disease control, migration prevention, hunger prevention, supporting human rights. And the same process has happened over at the State Department, where most foreign assistance grants, around 4,100, have been cut. The State Department says they've saved about $60 billion, which is around 1% of the overall federal budget.
Okay, now do we know what kind of programs have been cut?
Well, we don't have a full picture. The State Department says that programs that the USAID is keeping includes food and life-saving assistance for HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria. Secretary Rubio had issued a waiver for those after the stop work order paused all existing foreign aid programs. But we're hearing from aid groups and NGOs that life-saving humanitarian programs, including ones that provide HIV medications, have been terminated. So have programs providing vaccination for polio. And it seems like some of those termination notices have gone out in haste because some groups received them twice. Now, one example I can tell you about a program that's been cut is in Nigeria. It provided clean water for people who were displaced because of attacks by the militant group Boko Haram.
So what's been the reaction to all this?
One humanitarian official told me, quote, this is a global health massacre. That person was not authorized to speak on behalf of their organization. Now, USAID staff and aid groups are worried that cuts to USAID's programs will lead to loss of life, like in Sudan, where hunger is widespread, and over 1,000 kitchens supported by USAID have closed. Also, children around the world who are receiving treatment for acute malnutrition, they've not been getting their medication and are at risk of dying.
So where does this leave the agency USAID?
Well, it's been effectively dismantled. Today and tomorrow, hundreds of USAID staff who've been laid off or put on administrative leave will be allowed to go into the headquarters in Washington and pack up their stuff. The building doesn't have agency signage anymore. It's been removed. And the State Department says the next steps will be working with Congress to reform foreign assistance to ensure that taxpayer dollars are used to, quote, make America stronger, safer, and more prosperous. And the government owes about $1.5 billion to many aid organizations for work that was already done before the Trump funding freeze. And that is now tied up in the courts. The government was given a deadline to make those payments by midnight yesterday, but the Supreme Court intervened and extended the deadline.
All right, that's NPR's global health correspondent, Fatma Tanis. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Texas health officials say one person has died so far from the state's measles outbreak. There are now at least 124 confirmed cases. From member station KTTZ, Samantha Larned reports authorities are afraid the virus's spread is still in its early stages.
The patient was an unvaccinated school-aged child who had been hospitalized at Covenant Children's Hospital in Lubbock since last week. Health officials confirmed yesterday that the death was caused by complications with the measles virus. No further details were provided. Dr. Amy Thompson is the chief executive officer for Covenant Health, a regional health network based in Lubbock. She said around 20 patients had been admitted for measles, several requiring intensive care.
And as we can see from today's news, this virus can have severe and deadly consequences.
The last reported measles death in the U.S. was in 2015. The outbreak was first identified in late January in Gaines County. Since then, cases have been confirmed in at least 9 Texas counties. Health officials fear there are more measles cases that have not yet been identified. While early cases were traced to remote West Texas communities, it has now sparked health concerns statewide. Rockwall County, next to Dallas, confirmed its first measles case in an unvaccinated adult on Wednesday. The county's health authority says the case is not believed to be tied to the outbreak in West Texas. Earlier this week, a public health alert was issued in the San Antonio area after a person with measles traveled there from Gaines County earlier this month. So far, there are no confirmed cases in that region. On Wednesday, the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., said the department is following the situation and that measles outbreaks are, quote, not unusual, unquote, and happen every year. Covenant Health's chief medical officer, Dr. Laura Johnson, says there is a higher risk of complications, such as respiratory issues, for unvaccinated patients than for those who are vaccinated. Given the low vaccination rate of the most affected areas, Johnson expects cases to continue rising.
Unfortunately, statistically, there's a significant risk of having a death. I certainly hope we don't see any more, but I think we're fairly early still in this outbreak.
Health officials recommend those who are experiencing symptoms or have had a measles exposure stay at home and call a health care provider rather than going into a doctor's office waiting room and risking further exposure. For NPR News, I'm Samantha Larned in Lubbock.
President Trump has said on social media that tariffs on Canada and Mexico will go into effect on March 4th. It's the latest in a series of shifting dates for these penalties, which were initially scheduled to take place February 1st. As NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports, it's part of a pattern in the president's tariff threats.
President Trump ran for office promising big tariffs. Thus far, only one has gone into effect, a 10% tariff on Chinese goods. But he's proposed many more. He signed an executive order expanding steel and aluminum tariffs to go into effect on March 12th, though questions remain about how broadly they'll be applied. Then there are the Mexico and Canada tariffs. On Monday, Trump said they would start next week. By Wednesday, he was talking about an April start date.
April 2nd. I was going to do it on April 1st, but I'm a little bit superstitious. I made it April 2nd. The tariffs go on. not all of them, but a lot of them.
And then this morning, he posted on social media that the tariffs will indeed happen on March 4th. And he added another 10% tariff for China. Trump has also signed an order aimed at imposing reciprocal tariffs, potentially on all kinds of products from all trading partners. But the order doesn't impose tariffs. Instead, it sets in motion a research process. Here's how Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick has described it.
Our studies should be all complete by April 1st. So we'll hand the president the opportunity to start on April 2nd if he wants. So I think we'll be ready to go on April 1st.
Trump has also talked about cars and lumber. And this week, he announced an investigation that could lead to new tariffs on copper. None of this is normal, firstly because Trump is threatening tariffs on a weekly, even daily basis, but also because it's often unclear if or when many of these tariffs will happen, not to mention how big they'll be. There's an echo here of Infrastructure Week, a phrase that became a joke during Trump's first term, referring to big, repeated policy declarations with little follow-through. Scott Linsicum is a trade expert at the Libertarian Cato Institute and thinks the analogy broadly applies, with one big caveat.
We shouldn't dismiss the real costs that this is inflicting on various companies and the economy more broadly.
Tariffs can hurt consumers by spiking prices. But even when tariffs are merely threatened, the resulting uncertainty can drag on business investment. A manufacturer might delay a project until they know what steel and aluminum tariffs will look like. Indeed, in a 2020 study, economists at the Federal Reserve found that trade policy uncertainty during Trump's first term significantly cut business investment. There are differences between Trump now and Trump 8 years ago, Linsicum adds.
In Trump 1.0, you just got a tweet that said, oh, I'm going to slap tariffs on stuff. But we didn't actually get a signed executive order with a deadline, right? This is much more formal. And I think that has significant economic implications.
One of those signed orders would expand steel and aluminum tariffs. Trump said there would be no exemptions for any country, but countries are still pushing for them. With some tariffs, it's unclear what Trump's goals are. Chad Bound is at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and was chief economist for President Biden's State Department. He points to Trump's reciprocal tariff idea. Trump has said it's about fairness.
This is one argument that he's put forward, but it's one of many arguments that President Trump has put forward in the reasons why he might be using tariffs. And many of them are inconsistent with each other.
Which means that it can be hard to game out what might cause Trump to go through with or back down from some of his threats. It's not just economists taking Trump's tariff threats with several grains of salt. Markets are also assuming policy won't match Trump's grandest pronouncements, says Mike Reynolds, Vice President of Investment Strategy at wealth management firm Glenmead.
We think that the market's certainly looking at it probabilistically, right? We think that sort of the median likelihood, straight down the middle, is that they'll end up somewhere that's in between current policy and proposed policy.
The effects of tariff threats go beyond businesses and investors. This month, consumer confidence suffered its largest drop since 2021, fueled in part by fears that tariffs will stoke inflation. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
This is NPR News. On the next Fresh Air, Natasha Rothwell. She returns to the third season of HBO's The White Lotus as Belinda, the compassionate spa manager from season one. She'll talk about the unique experience of shooting in Thailand, as well as her time as a writer and performer on Insecure and her own show, How to Die Alone. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Cunard, with round trips from Miami to the Caribbean on Cunard's Queen Elizabeth. Guests can dine on flavors of the Caribbean and explore local life on shore in Antigua, Barbados, St. Lucia, and beyond. Learn more at Cunard.com. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education. At edutopia.org. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. President Trump says Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is expected in Washington, D.C. tomorrow to sign a preliminary deal for some of Ukraine's most valuable resources, including rare earth minerals. Zelensky has asked for security guarantees for his country in exchange. Trump said yesterday that the deal doesn't come with any, but Ukraine should still be pleased.
It's a great thing. It's a great deal for Ukraine, too, because they get us over there and we're going to be working over there. We'll be on the land. And, you know, in that way, it's this sort of automatic security because nobody's going to be messing around with our people when we're there.
We wondered why these minerals are so important. So our colleague Leila Fadel spoke with Gracelyn Baskerin, who directs the Critical Minerals Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Rare earths are the bedrock of national security, economic competitiveness, and energy resilience. So rare earths are used in almost every form of defense technology. Mm-hmm. Missiles, lasers, warships, fighter jets, munitions. They're also used in renewable energy. They're a core part of things like wind turbines. Now, we're facing increasing demand for rare earths, but the real driver of a lot of this foreign policy is because we are currently so reliant on China. China processes about 90% of the world's rare earths, and they've already shown a demonstrated track record of weaponizing them. Back in 2010, China and Japan got into a dispute over a fishing trawler, and China cut off exports of rare earths to Japan over it. And, you know, the U.S. is really doubling down and trying to find alternate supplies and rare earths because of how significant that dependence is at the forefront.
And is the U.S. trying to develop any of that here in the United States?
Yes. So we have Mountain Pass, which is a rare earth mine out west. But the big chokehold for the United States is actually not sourcing the rocks out of the ground. It's that processing that China has 90% capabilities of. And in the last 5 years, the United States has spent over $300 million through the Defense Production Act to build processing facilities here at home in the U.S. So we're currently building in California, we're currently building in Texas, and for like the heavy rare earth facility in Texas, it'll really be the first major facility outside of China.
Okay, so let's talk about Ukraine in that context. How extensive are their mineral deposits, and how far that will they go toward meeting U.S. needs?
So Ukraine has natural resources. There's no doubt they have minerals, oil and gas, and they have a range of minerals, uranium, coal, rare earths. What we don't know, because geological mapping of Ukraine, the most recent one was done about 30 to 60 years ago by the Soviet Union, is which of those deposits are economically viable to mine. We don't have that level of data. So first there has to be a mapping. Then it takes, on average globally, from that time I know exactly what my deposit is, 18 years to develop a mine. Mining is a generational effort, and we're very much at the start of a generation.
And so how much does this agreement, when it is or if it is done, between the United States and Ukraine, how much does it matter? Is it meaningful?
It's probably less meaningful than the attention it's getting. And the reason is because it's such a long-term effort, number one, that we are not going to have a producing mine because of this deal in the next 4 years. Mining outlives electoral cycles. That's number one. I think the second big thing is the private sector is the only determinant of whether this agreement yields anything at all. Given that the average mine and separation plant costs $500 million to $1 billion, that's a big ask, especially considering the risk of Russia next door.
Gracelyn Vaskaran, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
The share of Americans who identify as Christian is dropping, and those who say they're religiously unaffiliated now make up a major portion of the U.S. population. NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose has more from a new Pew Research study.
62% of U.S. adults now say they're Christian. That's down from the 78% Pew found in a similar survey back in 2007. However, that number has stabilized more recently. Greg Smith with Pew Research says the change is related to what he calls generational shifts.
You have more and more people who have no religion having children, and so you have more and more people who, as children, were raised with no religion, and many of them grow up to be not particularly religious themselves.
And Smith says fewer people are switching to Christianity from another religion.
There are about 6 people who were raised as Christians and no longer identify as such for every 1 convert to Christianity.
29% of Americans now identify as religiously unaffiliated, which can mean agnostic, atheist, or just nothing in particular. That's an all-time high, and the percentage of people in the U.S. who identify as a specific religion other than Christian is on the rise. They now make up just over 7% of the total U.S. population. Pew's Greg Smith says one of the especially interesting findings in this study is how major shifts have happened among political lines.
The decline of Christianity is much more pronounced among political liberals than conservatives. And in fact, among liberals, there are now more people who say they have no religion than there are who identify with Christianity.
While organized religion may be on the decline, Pew says spiritual beliefs are widespread. 86% of Americans believe in a soul, and 83% believe in a God. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
So, A, got any faves for the Oscars on Sunday? You want to handicap this?
Michelle, you know what I say. If there is an award show that I am not nominated in, then I really don't care.
Well, since A is not trying to help you out with your Oscar brackets, tomorrow on Morning Edition, we're going to talk with Pop Culture Happy Hour's Glenn Weldon about this weekend's awards and his predictions for Best Picture and probably some other things. You can listen on your phone, your smart speaker, or on your radio. This is NPR News.
For people in Greenland, dog sledding is more than just a sport. It's part of their identity.
You cannot just have a dog and just not think of it. It's just a part of who you are. The dog is a part of you.
Now, climate change is threatening this beloved tradition. I'm Juana Summers, the future of Greenlandic dog sledding on a warming planet. On All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump has signed an executive order expanding the powers of Elon Musk's cost-cutting team. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, known as DOGE, may now oversee routine federal spending.
Trump's executive order instructs federal agencies to work with DOGE to review contracts, grants, and other spending and make cuts, quote, where appropriate. The order also freezes all government credit cards for 30 days, with few exceptions. This impacts spending, but also strictly limits government travel for some agencies. It's the latest sign of support from Trump of Musk's work making aggressive cuts to the federal bureaucracy. Already, Musk's deputies have fired thousands of public sector workers and terminated contracts. But the real savings to taxpayers remains an open question. Some of the canceled contracts are old, counted twice or more by Musk's DOGE website, or have had zeros mistakenly added to the sums. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Trump is also giving federal agencies until March 13th to submit plans for reducing their workforces. President Trump says March 4th is the date when he will implement 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico and an additional 10% tariff on China. At his first cabinet meeting yesterday, Trump told reporters those tariffs would take effect in April. This is NPR News. Ending Russia's war in Ukraine is expected to be the major focus today at the White House when British Prime Minister Keir Starmer meets with President Trump. Their talks come a day before Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is due in Washington for a meeting with the president. Reports out of Thailand say more than 40 ethnic Muslim Uyghur asylum seekers who were being held in detention have been forcibly repatriated to China. Michael Sullivan has the latest.
The Uyghurs have been detained for more than a decade, and activists say they were secretly deported to China overnight. Thai officials have so far declined to confirm the reports. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said just last month he would urge Thailand not to send the Uyghurs home. Rights groups accuse China of systematic abuses of its mainly Muslim ethnic Uyghur minority, charges China denies. Early this morning, several vehicles with their windows blacked out left the immigration center where the Uyghurs were being held. Not long after, an unscheduled China Southern flight took off from Bangkok, arriving in China's Xinjiang region about 6 hours later. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai.
Authorities in New Mexico say foul play is not suspected in the deaths of Oscar-winning actor Gene Hackman and his wife Betsy. Their bodies were discovered yesterday at their home in Santa Fe. Hackman was 95. I'm Dave Mattingly.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Today, a federal judge in San Francisco hears arguments over whether the Trump administration's firing of thousands of probationary employees should be halted.
It is one of the many legal challenges the administration is coming up against as it moves forward with plans to downsize the federal workforce.
NPR's Andrew Hsu is following all of this. So, Andrew, let's start with what's happening in court today. Who brought this lawsuit?
Yeah, it was originally filed by several labor unions that represent federal workers who have been fired over the last several weeks. So nurses at the VA, for example, or people who worked for the Forest Service. These were employees who were still on probationary status, meaning usually their first or second year in that job. And a lot of them were told that they were being fired for performance reasons, even though many of them had gotten positive performance reviews and some weren't even on the job long enough to get a review. So the labor unions are arguing that the agencies themselves had no plans to fire these employees and only did so at the direction of the administration and specifically the Office of Personnel Management.
All right, the Office of Personnel Management, that's something we've heard a lot lately. So remind us what that is.
Yeah, OPM is the agency that handles HR functions for the federal workforce. But to be clear, its role is to provide guidance to agencies about how to hire and fire employees. It doesn't have the authority to actually hire and fire employees of other agencies. But under this administration, OPM has taken on a far bigger role. For instance, you remember that mass email that went out to the entire federal workforce last weekend asking, you know, what did you do last week? That came from OPM. And in fact, this lawsuit also includes a complaint about this email. The unions argue that OPM exceeded its authority in asking the entire federal workforce to report back what they accomplished, and also in telling agencies to fire their probationary employees. President Trump has repeatedly argued that he's revamping the federal workforce in order to save American taxpayers money and to clean up fraud and waste. But the union's attorneys say there's a way to go about doing that legally, and this is not it.
So apart from that lawsuit, I know you've reported on six fired workers who've been temporarily reinstated. Who are those workers?
Yeah, these are six employees at different federal agencies who were fired about 2 weeks ago, and they were part of a separate complaint that a different set of attorneys brought to the Office of Special Counsel. That's the federal watchdog agency that's responsible for protecting federal workers from illegal actions by the government. So the special counsel began looking into these firings and found evidence that agencies hadn't followed proper procedures for firing them. And this special counsel asked a separate federal board to issue a stay. And on Tuesday night this week, the board granted that and ordered these six workers reinstated through April 10th so that the special counsel's investigation can continue.
Okay, just only six people?
Yeah, for now. The attorneys in the case, including Michelle Berkovich, have asked the special counsel to seek relief for, you know, many thousands of probationary workers who say they were fired in the exact same way. Here's what she said.
I mean, these are hardworking individuals. Not only are these just people who have a job, they're people who want to make this country better.
And the Office of Special Counsel A, they have said that they're looking into ways to address a larger group of people who have been similarly fired. The office, though, doesn't normally pursue complaints like this, so this is really unprecedented, as are the firings that led to this investigation. And lastly, I'll just note that this week we also saw the Trump administration issue guidance to agencies on further downsizing, on deeper cuts that are ahead, so we may continue to see litigation there.
All right, that's NPR's Indra Hsu. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Today, we're hearing from two of the Venezuelan men detained in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba by the Trump administration. They say they were mistreated during their two-week detention at the naval base. They also allege they were kept from contacting an attorney, something that never happened on U.S. soil. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran brings us the story. And here's where I'd like to let you know that it does include the topic of suicide.
When Mayfred Duran Arape boarded the U.S. military aircraft in Fort Bliss, Texas on February 8th, he thought he was going back to Venezuela. That's what a detention officer had told him. But when that plane landed hours later, he was surprised.
Miró militar y vi que decía base naval Guantánamo.
He saw soldiers and a sign that said Naval Station Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He was among more than 170 Venezuelan men held at a facility at the base. It was all part of the Trump administration's vow to send some 30,000 people without legal status to the base before deporting them to other countries. Duran Arape and another detainee NPR spoke to alleged they were mistreated by soldiers who served as prison officers, were shackled every time they left the cells, and were chastised for talking to each other. Duran Arape alleges he demanded a call with an attorney, but was told no. So he, along with others, blocked the camera in their cells to catch the guard's attention. He would also kick the cell's door. They would come and beat me, he says. Duran Arapé alleges the mistreatment got so bad, he tried to die by suicide twice in the 2 weeks he was in Guantanamo. He provided NPR with photos of injuries on his wrists, hands, and knuckles. Duran Arapé thought he was going to stay at Guantanamo forever. A spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security tells NPR the agency cannot confirm the veracity of Duran Arapé's claims. She says the detainees have, quote, access to phone utilization to reach lawyers, but provided no details or evidence. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt was asked this week about some of the allegations made by migrants held in Guantanamo. She says President Trump has promised to go after immigrants in the country without legal status to break the law, and that the administration could send people who commit, quote, heinous acts of violence to Guantanamo.
These are criminals we are talking about. Don't forget that.
But the Trump administration has admitted in court documents that nearly 30% of the detainees were considered, quote, low-threat illegal aliens who didn't have a serious criminal record. The documents were part of a case brought by the American Civil Liberties Union that demanded migrants in Guantanamo get access to attorneys. Legal Aren't with the ACLU says his organization has already started hearing what he describes as horrendous stories about the conditions in Guantanamo.
Guantanamo has always been a place in which abuse can occur because it's so remote and there's a lack of transparency.
The detainees NPR spoke to say they also held a five-day hunger strike. Joiner Purro y Roldán participated in a protest against the conditions at Guantanamo. That's not a detention center. That's not a place for people like us, he says. Guantanamo is for people who have felonies, who have killed others. Purro y Roldán was accused of being part of Tren de Aragua, a Venezuelan gang recently designated by the Trump administration as a foreign terrorist organization. But the only crime on his record is that of illegal entry to the U.S. He says he has nothing to do with the gang. DHS did not respond to an email about his claims. He says only on the last day of his detention was he allowed to call a lawyer. Purro y Roldán says he wants justice. He says they are not criminals. Sergio Martinez Beltrán, NPR News.
Let me remind you here, if you or someone you know may be considering suicide or is in crisis, call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. This is NPR News.
Vertical short videos, these serialized dramatic stories told in under 2 minutes, got their start in China and now are a multi-billion dollar business. Next time here and now.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Good morning, Mae Martinez. Payments from the Tooth Fairy, who is totally real in case there's someone in the backseat, dropped for a second year in a row. That's according to a survey of parents from the insurer Delta Dental. The average payout last year was $5.01, which is still way up from the $1.30 kids got back in 1998. You know,
I've always wondered why, when kids lose a tooth, a fairy leaves cash. But when older people lose teeth, no fairy to be found. Suspish. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners and detainees were freed from Israeli jails today after Hamas last night handed over the bodies of four Israeli hostages who were kidnapped in the attacks of October 7, 2023. This is the seventh hostage exchange since a very fragile ceasefire started on January 19th. NPR's Hadil Alshalji is with us with more from Tel Aviv. Good morning, Hadil.
Good morning.
So it was a very late night for people in Israel who were following the hostage exchange. Just to tell us about it. Tell us what happened.
Yeah. So at around 2 a.m. here, Israel said it had received the bodies of four men. Their names are Ohad Yahalomi, Itzhak Egarat, Tzachi Edan, and Shlomo Mansour. In previous exchanges, you should know that Hamas has held these handover ceremonies. They march the hostages onto a stage. They give them mics to do speeches, make them wave happily at the crowds. And then when they've returned hostage bodies, they made a whole spectacle of carrying the coffins onto ambulances with music and chanting. But this time there was no ceremony. And Israel said Egyptian mediators helped get the caskets onto Red Cross ambulances in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza and then back to Israel. Now we know, according to the Israeli government, that about 25 live hostages are still in Gaza and more than 30 bodies.
And what happened with the Palestinian prisoners released? How did that go about?
So last week's prisoner release was actually delayed after Israel called those ceremonies I just told you about humiliating. You know, last week Hamas even released this video of a couple of hostages that were still being held, watching the ceremony and begging into the camera for Israel to extend the ceasefire. So Israel delayed the release last week in protest. But then yesterday, Hamas and Israel struck a deal. No ceremony was held overnight, like I said. And so around the same time as Israeli hostage bodies were handed over, a Red Cross convoy left Ofer prison in the West Bank. It drove to Ramallah, and crowds of cheering family and friends received the released prisoners. We know that 642 Palestinian prisoners and detainees were released. 600 of them were sent back to Gaza. Many of them were Palestinians arrested right after October 7th. And some of those also released are people who were serving time for killing Israelis in deadly attacks.
You know, the first phase of the ceasefire expires on Saturday. So where do things stand with the talks? What happens after?
Yeah, well, you know, the short answer is really, we just don't know. There has been some pressure from Qatar, Egypt, to the States, but it's not really clear if any actual sit-down talks have happened to figure out what a second phase will look like. You know, technically, the second phase is when everyone, you know, sort of decides how Israel fully withdraws its troops from Gaza and everyone makes a commitment to end the war. Israel says it's expecting the U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East, Steve Witkoff, this week. He helped broker this first phase, and he's supposed to push the talks forward. There's also been talk of Israel wanting an extension of this first phase to get more hostages out, but nothing is set in stone yet. Look, Hamas doesn't want the war to start up so it can take a break, perhaps rebuild, and Israel doesn't want the war to start up to bring home the rest of the hostages. So it's all still a very precarious time.
NPR's Hadil Alshalji in Tel Aviv. Hadil, thank you.
You're welcome.
Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. ¶¶
AI world, according to NVIDIA.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bitwarden Password Manager for Business, designed to make the most out of 2025 IT budgets to ensure long-term enterprise security success. Learn more at bitwarden.com.
I'm David Brancaccio. NVIDIA is a key company at the heart of this emerging artificial intelligence revolution. It made microprocessors for computer gaming that turned out to be great to grind out AI. Its quarterly results are in as of yesterday, the first that reflect the realization that DeepSeek of China had come up with a workable AI system that uses a lot fewer microchips. But NVIDIA is insisting there's still plenty of room for its business to grow. Marketplace's Nova Safo reports.
NVIDIA is forecasting that its sales will increase in the next quarter to about $43 billion. The company also has profit margins of more than 70%, although it expects them to narrow slightly as it spends more to produce its new advanced chips called Blackwell. Those chips are selling briskly, despite China showing AI efficiency advancements through a model called DeepSeek. That's because more advanced AI systems are coming, and they'll need computing power. Still, the news about profit margins and profit and sales numbers that were not as stellar as previous results left investors somewhat lukewarm. That's because NVIDIA has set a huge standard for itself. A primary beneficiary of the AI boom, its shares have risen nearly 2,000% in 5 years. Its stock price took a tumble after DeepSeek came out and has yet to recover to its previous high. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
NVIDIA stock is down 3.1% now. Intel is up 2.25%. The Dow, I see, is up 394 points now, 0.9%. The S&P is up slightly 3 points. The NASDAQ is down 0.5%. There is news this morning that the number of people putting in applications for jobless benefits jumped to 242,000 in the last week. That is a three-month high. Layoffs in recent months go well beyond the federal workers being targeted by the Government Efficiency Advisory Group in Washington. Among the private companies that have announced layoffs of 1,000 people or more, Chevron, Facebook, Meta, Starbucks, Southwest Airlines, and many more. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that.
Overall, the job market is still pretty strong. But Andy Challenger at outplacement firm Challenger Gray & Christmas is bracing for worse to come.
We expect a lot more job cuts because of conversations I'm having with companies. I'm hiring like crazy.
Sad but true, the firm's busier when a lot of newly laid off workers need help finding jobs. Challenger says the tech and housing sectors have been gradually downsizing, but now
I'm starting to see a much wider array of industries beginning job cuts. Companies revise downward their growth outlooks, getting leaner, getting more cost effective.
Americans are getting more pessimistic, says Stephanie Guichard at the conference board, with fewer people saying it'll be easy to find a job in the future. But
we don't see people being worried about losing their jobs. Sentiment about future income is still positive.
And, says Andy Challenger,
even though there are lots of layoffs in the news, also from the public sector in a way that we haven't really ever seen, I wouldn't be too depressed or dismayed about the job market.
With unemployment at a still very low 4%. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
Mi nombre es César. Yo soy trabajador jornalero.
My name is Cesar. I am a day laborer. I mostly do landscaping, construction, and painting. All of this started because we were seeing that many of our employers had lost their properties. Now I am affected because I will not have a job for a long time. For me, it has been a real satisfaction to be able to help these people. I have received training for cases of natural disasters and certified by OSHA. We went to bring hot food to people who didn't want to leave their homes because they thought they were going to be robbed. These houses had no electricity and no water. We were bringing hot food. My friends knocked on the door and an elderly person came out.
cómo se miraba psicológicamente afectado.
When I saw this person, I could see his expression, how psychologically affected he looked.
Y yo me pude dar cuenta que era una persona hispana.
And I could tell that he was a Hispanic person. I started to speak to him in Spanish to make him feel better. I could see his emotions when he heard the language, and he felt a little more comfortable.
Yo pude verlo afectado en la emoción de su rostro.
I could see the emotion on his face. My friends offered him food. He really didn't want food.
Quería sacar todo lo que él llevaba por dentro, tener una conversación con alguien, él que se sentía solo.
He wanted to get everything out that he had on the inside, to have a conversation with someone since he felt alone. I felt very pleased, and that night I went home calmly and happy because I knew that my work was doing something good. I feel very good as an immigrant, and I believe that immigrants are an important part of the United States. The immigrant workforce is important because we work and many of us pay taxes when we buy things. We pay a tax that is never reimbursed to us.
Pagamos un impuesto que nunca es reembolsado para nosotros.
We withheld Cesar's last name over privacy concerns. To review, he's among so many who mobilized to help neighbors deal with the terrible Southern California wildfires, immigrant day laborers who volunteer their time to clear wreckage and other fire debris under the auspices of what's called the Pasadena Community Jobs Center. The center is run by the National Day Laborer Organizing Network, which during normal times works to help people find paid jobs. There's more at marketplace.org. If you missed it on the air, the English voice over there was by our Juan Carlos Dorado. I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. APM American Public Media.
Clever Skipper. There was a clever skipper in Akron, he did well, who had a lovely woman and a tailor she loved well. Did you ever hear the story? Then listen what I say. She was walking up South Howard Street. Who but the tailor did she chance for to meet? Tummerally, tally, dally, tummerally, tally day. They wined, dined, and danced. It was late by the clock. When up stepped the captain, and loudly he did knock. Tum-a-rally, tally-dally, tum-a-rally, tally-day. They were surprised. Taylor said so quiet meek. Now, my lovely woman, and oh, where shall I creep? Tum-a-rally, tally-dally, tum-a-rally, tally-day. In yonder's cupboard, my husband has a chest. Yes, in that cupboard, a cover you may hide. Tum-a-rally, tally-dally, tum-a-rally, tally.